Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, a retirement, a replacement, and a more conservative court. Less than 2 years into his first term, President Trump has the opportunity to put another justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll consider what the loss of Anthony Kennedy means for the court's balance, what a new conservative from the president will mean for key issues, and the politics of getting the president's choice through the Senate. So as our guests join us, are there particular issues that you think may be affected when the court has a more conservative tilt? What questions come to mind for you as voters, as Americans, as court watchers for what happens next? So particular issues that you are interested, and then overall, the questions that come to mind about what happens next. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. At Carrie NPR. Timothy Johnson is here in the studio with me. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of Minnesota. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Carrie.
David Levine is with us. He's a professor of law at the UC Hastings College of Law in San Francisco and Berkeley. And David, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
I'd love to hear both of you on the pivotal swing vote that we've heard that Kennedy, this role that he has played for some time. And I want to ask you each for one case in which he really held the outcome in his hand. So, Tim, go first on that.
Sure. So let me begin with the notion of him being the swing justice. And for a long time in the modern history of the U.S. Supreme Court, it was thought that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was the most powerful justice on the court. And that, of course, was true for some time. And especially after she left, that moniker changed to Justice Anthony Kennedy. And if you just look at the data over the terms that he sat from 1987 through this most recent term, the 2017 term, he authored 11% of all opinions that you would deem conservative, and he also authored 11% of all opinions that you would deem liberal. He was second only to Justice Scalia on the conservative side and second only to Justice John Paul Stevens on the liberal side. So he really did hold that swing vote in his hands. In terms of the most important issue, I really do think it comes down to abortion rights for women. He really held the overturning of Roe at bay all the way through Casey in 1992. And that is going to be the key debate, I believe, that will run, I think, the debate in the Senate over who the next nominee is going to be and how difficult that debate will be.
We'll dig into that in a minute. So, David, your thought on why Kennedy ended up being such a pivotal vote and then a case that really displays that.
Sure. Well, I totally agree with the analysis we just heard in terms of Justice Kennedy's impact. Just this last term, I think, 14 or 16 5-4 opinions, of which he joined every single one of those. On the conservative side, but the opinion I'll pick is is the series that led to same-sex marriage, culminating in Obergefell versus Hodges from 2015, a 5-4 opinion shifting over time the status of gays and lesbians in the country. And without a doubt, if he had not been pushing that, it never would have happened.
We have a question on Twitter here from Emily, who says, what will the new court mean for gay marriage? Is there any danger of those rights being taken away? David, what do you think?
Sure. Well, I guess I'd separate it into two things. One is, I feel as if the issue of same-sex marriage per se, I think, is settled. In the sense that there's been such wide acceptance. Yes, there's issues that have popped up, but by and large, wide acceptance on that issue. You don't see that as a big rallying cry now for elections, that sort of thing. However, I think the issue that's going to come up is, what is the reach of a case like Obergefell, which is it simply about same-sex marriage? What about other things, such as adoption? What about, I'm sure we'll get into it later, Masterpiece Cake, the idea that somebody can say, my religious beliefs don't allow me to do something for gays and lesbians. In that case, bake a cake. How much is that going to be opened? How much would a new court, a Kennedy-less court, open up the religious claims and therefore chip away at gays and lesbians' rights?
Tim,
part of it has to, I'm sorry.
No, David, please finish your thoughts. Sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. The last thing I was going to say is part of it has to do with Justice Kennedy's style in writing some of his opinions, of which Obergefell is a perfect example. How did he get to deciding that there had to be same-sex marriage across the country? He did it in a way that was the way he sometimes will write a little bit up in the clouds about that Justice Scalia, of course, took him to task for. And the reason that's important is, What is the reach? Again, is it a marriage case or is it more about the legal status of gays and lesbians? And to the degree that it was subject to some criticism, it's because he went with the former, that it's so much a marriage case and less a status case.
So, Tim, again, to answer Emily here, I hear David saying that case itself is probably solid, but some of the questions that come up around that case may be reconsidered by this new conservative court.
I think that's absolutely right. David makes a really good point. This would be very similar to what happened after Roe versus Wade in 1973, that the conservative majority that started to build after John Stevens was placed on the court in 1975 was chipping away at the rights of women, right? So you continue to have that right to choose abortion on demand, but there were all sorts of limitations that states and the federal government were placing on that right that the court was upholding. And David is spot on that that's sort of the direction that the court may go. The court may not want to polarize the citizenry in the United States more by saying we're going to go back and revisit and maybe overturn Obergefell, but we'll simply chip away at that particular right by saying, you know, we're going to look at adoption. We're going to look at other cases like Masterpiece.
David also mentioned that Kennedy could be criticized for his writing style sometimes. I was listening to Nina Totenberg this morning, and she was on NPR, and she was analyzing the critique that also came to him because he could see both sides of the issue. So let's listen to how Kennedy thought about that and how we hear him working through that.
They knew times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper in fact serve only to oppress.
She said that he was harshly criticized for this capability of seeing some of these issues in a rounder, more fuller way. What would you say about that?
Yeah, that criticism is quite accurate. He took that criticism from the right and from the left, and he took it most harshly from his colleague and I know friend Justice Scalia. And that was because there were often times when Justice Kennedy's decisions were not well grounded in very key or very concrete jurisprudential values. He often would make decisions on issues that would bring him to the argument of dignity, for example. And so he used that argument in not only more general gay rights cases, but in the same-sex marriage case. He would use the argument about dignity in some of the abortion decisions that he helped write. And he used that concept as well in the death penalty cases. In Roper v. Simmons, for instance, where he authors the opinion that says we are no longer going to put to death people who commit murder under the age of 18. And so he was criticized both for that idea of not grounding his arguments in what Justice Scalia would deem, for instance, the law, but then he would use these concepts like dignity that don't really have any basis at all in our constitutional structure.
Okay, that's really interesting. So, David, is there anything less, I should say, I guess, meaningful for a justice to also be thinking about an issue like dignity, a characteristic like dignity, than just embedding these decisions in the law? I guess I would ask you, we want our Supreme Court justices to be wise, don't we? Don't we want them also to consider things like what the dignity of humanity means as they're making these decisions?
Oh, I think absolutely, because thinking about the consequences of the actions, I think, is hugely important. And sometimes you want to pull back to that 35,000 foot level with concepts like that, the abstraction of dignity, liberty, that sort of thing. But I think the problem sometimes with Justice Kennedy's opinions whether you're looking left or right, is that you also need to come down to a level where lawyers and lower court judges have something to hang on to so that they can apply these directives from the Supreme Court in a predictable way so that you can handle disputes. People have a reasonable idea of what is clearly decided and not clearly decided. And so that when you're up in the clouds a little bit, it can be maddening down at the lower levels. Really, just to be able to settle a case.
I mean,
and what are the implications of the opinion?
Would you both say that he, and taking note, Tim, of what you said about how when Sandra Day O'Connor left, he moved into this more kind of pivotal role. Was he always a moderate, or was it the evolution of the court and the individual justices that kind of positioned him into that, what appeared to be a moderate role sometimes? What would you say?
So I think it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, the right was certainly not happy that he was ending up being the third choice of President Reagan when he was put on the bench. We need to remember the first choice when Justice Kennedy was put on the bench and ultimately confirmed by the Senate was Robert Bork, who would have been arguably the most conservative justice to ever sit on the bench, and that would include Justices Thomas and Scalia, who did sit on the bench. And when that went away, President Reagan, his second pick, Douglas Ginsburg, ended up pulling his name from consideration as well. And so Justice Kennedy comes in. He certainly was a conservative, but he was always leaning towards that moderate position that was held by Justices O'Connor or White or Blackmun or Powell over their tenure on the U.S. Supreme Court. So it is what I described to my students. Justice Kennedy was a right-leaning moderate for the vast majority of his career.
David, I read something interesting in a New York Times profile of him yesterday. He's from the state that you're in right now, California. He grew up in Sacramento. And here's a paragraph about where he came from and how this may have shaped his views. Justice Kennedy's parents were political and social fixtures in the Capitol. His father, Anthony, known as Bud, was a Republican lobbyist who represented tobacco interests, a whiskey-drinking, cigar-smoking, poker-playing, keep-your-cards-to-your-vest attorney, said Dr. David Dozier, a retired neurologist and friend of the justices since kindergarten. His mother, Gladys, called Sis, hosted backyard parties for legislators and their wives. You know, he was steeped in the political culture of Sacramento. I wasn't aware of that. What did you think that meant for his development as a judge?
What I think of is a little bit in later, just slightly later life, which is that he stayed in Sacramento until he moved to Washington to be a justice. And so that it's, you know, it's a small city, and yes, without a doubt, it's a political place, something like Albany, New York, as like, you know, a capital city remote from a little bit remote from a bigger city. But what I want to focus on is what he did until he became a Ninth Circuit judge, which is he was a law professor, and he probably is doing this right this minute, or if not this minute, next week. He continued to teach for the local law school for McGeorge while he was in practice. He would teach while he was a Ninth Circuit judge. He loved doing it. He's an extremely popular teacher for McGeorge. And the reason I say that is that even as a justice, he continued to do that. He would teach in their summer program in Salzburg, Austria. And that's why I'm thinking he might be doing that this week, but certainly by next week. So he had exposure to a very different world than, you know, that, you know, whiskey, cigars kind of image of a state capital. And so that he had exposure in that way. And I know from people who are on that faculty what a popular colleague he continues to be, how well thought of, how much the students liked him. And then, of course, you know, he didn't have a parochial education. Stanford and Harvard will rub off on you. So you put that together. And then he had many years on the Ninth Circuit where, yes, he was one of the conservative members of the Ninth Circuit, but rubbing shoulders with a lot of some of the most liberal judges in the country.
Yeah. David Levine is with us. If you've just tuned in, he's a professor of law at UC Hastings College of Law in San Francisco, and Timothy Johnson in the studio with me, a professor of law and political science at the University of Minnesota. Taking note, and if you're thinking, boy, you've done a lot of coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court this week, yes, we have. And there was more news yesterday morning that Justice Kennedy is retiring. That gives President Trump his second choice of a Supreme Court, or another pick, I should say, for the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're talking about how important Kennedy was to some major decisions that came from the U.S. Supreme Court, trying to understand his approach to the law. And then, of course, we're going to talk about some of the questions that come up around who the president will choose to replace him and what that means in the political process of getting confirmation through the Senate. Are there issues that come to mind now with Kennedy's retirement that you're concerned about or interested in as the court, I think we can expect, takes a more conservative tilt? Are there questions you have about the political process? What happens now? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Katrina in St. Paul. Hey, Katrina, hi.
Hi.
What's your question for our guests?
My question is, what is the likelihood that the next justice will be anything other than a white man?
Tim?
I think that there's a very high probability that it will be a white male. I think that the vast majority of those who are on President Trump's shortlist, which numbers between 25 and 30, depending
on. Oh, there's that many?
He said he's going back to the list that they had created when he picked Justice Gorsuch, but that they also have added somewhere around five new names. I think, hands down, there's a very high probability it's a white male.
And the reason for that is just because he's choosing among conservatives, and that's who often legal scholars ends up at the top of the list?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that it might not be the best strategic move for President Trump. There are some more conservative women and people of color who are on the federal circuits at this current time that he could choose from. But I think that just given what he did with Justice Gorsuch, that's probably the direction he's going to go.
David, you'd concur with that?
I think that's probably true. I mean, you know, Mr. Trump put out that list. Yes, it was revised, but it was to give aid and comfort to a certain kind of part of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And by nature of the people who made those selections, you do have a list that is way overrepresented with white men. Yes, there's a few women on the list. Amy Barrett, I'm just glancing at the list now. Mm-hmm. Amy Barrett, who was a professor at Notre Dame before she joined the Seventh Circuit recently. Joan Larson's, I think, was on the Michigan court, and then she's on the Sixth Circuit. But I think at the end of the day, yeah, it's going to be one of the white men.
Interesting observation here from Ron Brownstein, who writes for The Atlantic. Tim, who I love to read, I really respect. He's writing, the SCOTUS Republican majority sent an unmistakable signal that it is unlikely to meaningfully dissent from a Trump-era GOP agenda that systematically targets white anxieties about a rapidly diversifying country. Do you think he's got the politics of this right, since you teach poli-sci too?
Sure, sure. No, I think he really does. And part of that reason is not just the ideology of those who are on the court and presumably of the new nominee and presumably then the new justice, but this conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court is also a very big fan of executive power.
Ah.
That is that they are very willing to defer to the executive. And you saw that even all the way back to the court upholding the Obamacare decision, that there was some idea of deference when Chief Justice Roberts writes that opinion. And so, yes, it's ideological, but it is also this idea of we let the elected branches do their business. And in this case, the business is going to be coming out of the executive branch, and we will support that.
Isn't this why Roberts decided the way he did on the travel ban? He was deferring in some ways to executive power.
Absolutely. And so the idea, I mean, we can talk about all of the other outcomes and issues surrounding that case, but at its very heart, you hit the nail on the head, Carrie. That case comes down to a deference to the chief executive of the United States, and that is the president.
To Scott in Excelsior. Hi, Scott. Your question for our guests.
Hi. Yeah. I'm just wondering, I saw a post that talked about the Democrats trying to avoid a quorum to get a vote on this. They were going to, you know, all just kind of leave the chamber and not report back, and that wouldn't get the minimum number of senators there to approve the next justice. I'm wondering what kind of effects that would have and if that would work.
David, would that work?
It sounds like what the Democrats tried when Scott Walker came in your neighboring state of Wisconsin.
It does.
It worked for a short while, but not for that long. I don't know that that would work. What I've heard instead is the question of whether you could manage to get enough votes, 50 votes, for the idea that no nominee should go forward. The idea would be that given that Senator McConnell managed to avoid a vote on Judge Garland for the seat that Justice Gorsuch got on the grounds that an election was coming up, that maybe you could garner the one or two Republicans to say, well, it's sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander, let's wait till after the election. I think that's a slightly more a more likely strategy, but I don't know that it's going to succeed.
Doesn't sound like it, Tim, when you hear what McConnell's schedule looks like. We've got a midterms in early November. He sounds like he wants to get this new justice confirmed by then.
There is no doubt that they want this justice sitting on the bench on the first Monday in October, the first day of the court's term. And I think that it will not be that difficult for Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate to do so. I think the one play that the Democrats could have had would have been to invoke the filibuster.
I was just going to ask you about
but
this.
I'm glad that I read your mind. They absolutely lost that fight when they pushed it to the extreme and the filibuster was gotten
this
rid
was
of
the
for
nuclear
America.
Option. Remember this?
Exactly. And that nuclear option now, at least from the Democrats' perspective, would have been better used now, and they could have pushed it out to the midterms possibly because it took so much longer for the Republicans to get through that process for Neil Gorsuch because they had to go through those machinations of that nuclear option of getting rid of the filibuster. And obviously that option's off the table.
I remember Harry Reid being warned about this at the time, right? Be careful of what you're doing here because it's going to have consequences into the years out.
That's right. And the natural consequences would usually just be when you come into power, now you've got a problem going on as well, right? But that is actually not necessarily the case. It's going to come back to bite the Democrats immediately because, as David suggests, they don't have any real recourse. The not getting a quorum might work for a couple of days. Maybe getting one senator, and it turns out it probably would just be one senator because Senator McCain is still in firm out in Sedona, Arizona, and it's unclear if he will make his way back to Washington, D.C. And then it really would come down to that argument relying on one of the moderate Republicans who might be very worried about a case like Roe versus Wade saying, okay, let's just
Susan
wait.
Susan Collins.
Or Olympia Murkowski. Snow or Murkowski.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Call here from Carolyn in Winona. Hi, Carolyn. Your question.
Hi, my question is exactly that. Who are the moderates? Give us some names, please. That's the first question. The second question is I've heard people talking about a general strike of the populace. What do you think of that idea?
Okay. David, you want to weigh in on who you think the
sure.
moderates are?
Sure,
yeah,
the moderates,
good.
You'd look to Collins and Murkowski because they have been strong supporters of a woman's right to choose. And if you really thought that Roe versus Wade was going to be right on the chopping block, maybe they would go in that direction. The other ones you might think about would be the senators who have been liberated because they're not running for reelection. More conservative people, but somebody like Senator Flake, Senator Cork, or just because they don't have that problem. Now, on the flip side, the other ones to look for who would go the other direction, who would have a lot of pressure, are Democratic senators who are running for re-election in red states.
Joe
Heidi
Manchin.
Heitkamp,
yeah.
Manchin
right.
and Donnelly in Indiana are the ones who come to mind, is that it might be awfully hard for them to resist the pressure to at least provide a vote because they're going to worry about their own skins. So I think they may end up going the other direction of let's at least have a vote.
A call here from PJ in Graceville. Hey, PJ, hi. Thanks for waiting.
I was wondering if the court kind of naturally repositions itself, even though it could become more conservative, that the other justices kind of reposition themselves relative to the shift. And I think of Roberts in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Would he potentially move to become a little bit more moderate, much like the Minnesota Twins of old did, even though they were appointed by a Republican?
Yeah, this is a really good question, because we were talking about how when Sandra Day O'Connor left, here moves Kennedy into this kind of vacuum on the court. What do you think, Tim?
So it is an empirical fact that Chief Justice Roberts will now be the median justice on the bench. Ideologically, he is going to sit in the center. And I think that the caller raises a really good question, one that obviously only time will tell. But this is now the Roberts court. As the median, he truly does control everything that goes on this court, even though he is, as we know, just one among equals, realistically. I think there is some idea, and I think that there is some hope for that left side, if that's what folks on the left are thinking, that he will moderate to some extent because he understands, as most, if not all presidents do, that his office is greater than it being John Roberts' seat. And so I think that he will be that force that will say, we can't simply go off the deep end and start overturning every single precedent known to humankind, because that's going to leave a legacy not only of scorched earth in the legal area, but it's going to leave a legacy of the Roberts Court not being a very good court. No. So he will sort of be that quote unquote voice of reason, if you will. He very well could be.
That might be very important in what happens with the Roe v. Wade. Yeah, David, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to jump in on that, which is I do agree in terms of Chief Justice Roberts, and he is somebody who is particularly concerned about institutional legitimacy of the court. This is something that I've heard him lecture about, and it clearly is close to his heart. And the Affordable Care Act case is probably exhibit number one on that in the way that he came down on it. But the way this may come out is, in terms of you need five votes for an opinion, is that what may well happen is that instead of a scorched earth policy, it'll be chipping away at some of these rights, and that Roberts might be willing to join in incremental change where to the right, whereas he might not be as willing to go along with massive leaps to the right.
I have a tweet here from Mallory who says, as a white woman fully aware of my privilege, I never thought I'd be so scared for my own future and the future of the country. I never thought we'd actually get to the point where my right to a legal abortion could go away. We're going to take a look at the latest news when we come back. We'll talk about what this second appointment or nomination that the president gets to make to the U.S. Supreme Court means for Roe v. Wade. There was a lot of analysis yesterday that you could see the end of Roe in sight. I want to ask our guests about that, and we'll listen to what Justice Kennedy has said in the past on Roe v. Wade. Timothy Johnson from the U of M in studio with me. David Levine with us from the UC Hastings College of Law in San Francisco in California. And let's get to Roe v. Wade, because this is something that got a lot of conversation immediately yesterday. Let's listen to Justice Kennedy on Roe and then talk about what the future is.
Our cases recognize the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted governmental intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life.
Tell me what he's saying and what he's wrestling with there, Tim.
Yeah, so Justice Kennedy is wrestling with who gets to make that decision, and that is it just a decision between a woman and her doctor and potentially her spouse, right, because he uses the word couple.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also then wrestling with the idea of when does a state get to say no to a woman's right to choose. And so he's thinking both legally, but he's also bringing in this concept of liberty. That's his libertarianism coming through, where you do want, or he did want, people to be free from governmental interests or governmental decision making when they're making those sorts of choices. So he wrestled with all of that.
So, David, that voice will now be gone from the court, and a more conservative jurist will consider any other new challenges on abortion. What do you think happens with Roe?
I think what will happen is that we will start to see cases come up where different states will have put different restrictions on the right to choose. It could be the kind of medical facilities. It could be the cutoff for time. You know, is it a 12-week cutoff? Is it a 16-week cutoff? That sort of thing. And what the new court could do is use Justice Kennedy's language of undue burden and just continue to say, well, that is not a quote-unquote undue burden. That's not an undue burden. And it will chip away and chip away and chip away at the base of Roe. And then someday down the line, that group will say, okay, Roe is a dead letter. So it will take a little while to get there. Now, then the third thing I want to say is, just before the break, you had the I guess, the tweet from the caller, yeah. from the listener, saying, I fear what will happen is that this issue then will be returned to the states in large, large measure. And so it will be up to the state legislatures. Now, in lots of states, yes, the right to choose would disappear from that state, but in others it would not. California, I think we're pretty confident it wouldn't change because of the California Constitution and the makeup of the California legislature, but I don't know in Minnesota or in other states what would happen.
I think about, Tim, some of those laws that were passed by the Texas state legislature with the ambulatory centers and what the effect of that was it really limited access to abortion. Now, courts came in and turned those laws over. Is that what you think is meant by the chipping and the chipping, and that the Supreme Court might look more favorably on laws like that?
That's absolutely right. So that is the concept that David was talking about that Justice O'Connor initially introduced into abortion jurisprudence, and then Justice Kennedy helped elevate to the standard the court uses in Casey back in 1992. And so, yes, you get a decision that Kennedy actually was part of the majority that overturns that Texas statute that made very specific requirements both on doctors and clinics that provide abortions, and said, look, if you put these restrictions on, you're going to make women who want or need to obtain abortions have to travel sometimes hundreds, if not maybe over 1,000 miles to obtain that legal medical service. And that is an undue burden. And so I think that those sorts of decisions, David is spot on, that those will be the ones that will be revisited and could potentially and most likely will be used to chip away at the Roe decision.
So David suggested that eventually the Roe decision would be considered to be a quote unquote dead letter. I mean, does that, in your view, does that happen without any overall challenge to Roe v. Wade? It just doesn't mean anything because individual states are making their own laws and they're being validated by the court.
Exactly, right. So if you are at the point where the court does say this is or we are going to leave it up to the states, then yeah, Roe is simply meaningless. I will put this in a little bit of historical context for you. Both in 1989 and 1992, Justice Blackmun, of course, the infamous author of Roe versus Wade, was asked right prior to the term whether or not Roe was dead. And in both cases, he said, absolutely, Roe is gone. I'm very sad. It's a sad start of the term for me. And in neither 1989 nor 1992 was Roe actually overturned. Huh. And in 1992, Justice Kennedy actually wrote a note to Justice Blackmun right as they were deciding Planned Parenthood versus Casey and said, Harry, you need to come to my office. I've got something to tell you. Much of what I'm going to tell you, you're going to like. And that is, we're not going to overturn Roe versus Wade at this time. And that's where this becomes so important, because if and when a new justice comes on the bench, he or she will not be placed near that median justice. This is what political scientists call a critical nomination, because it will change the court from having this moderate right-leaning justice to someone who is probably more conservative than Justice Thomas.
By the way, for listeners, we're going to talk more about Roe v. Wade and some of these individual laws in individual states on abortion. Then, of course, we will take note of what is happening with the Kennedy retirement. That's coming up early next week, I believe on Tuesday. Caller here from Preston in Wilmer. Hey, Preston. Hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. I know Justice Gorsuch answer some very direct questions during his confirmation. And so I would assume for this next appointee, they would face those same hard questions from Democratic senators. But if it would come to ruling in that case from a state, wouldn't that be kind of hard for them to rule in a different way? Wouldn't that be seen as hypocritical in some perspective?
David, what would you say?
Well, there will be hard questions, but I would disagree in this sense with Justice Gorsuch that he didn't necessarily answer those hard questions except to say, I'm independent, I'll take them as they come, I can't comment on that. And the lower court judges who have gotten through, who President Trump has nominated, all do the same thing, even to some extremes. And I'll bet you anything that whoever the nominee is, they're going to be trained in the same way. So the Democrats will ask hard questions, and the nominee will say platitudes.
Yes, Tim?
Absolutely, right. This is known as the Ginsburg rule. And if it's something that we are going to vote on or potentially could vote on, I will not speak about it.
Sonita called to say, why are we talking in terms of Republican conservatives when the Supreme Court is supposed to be apolitical? That's a really good question. There was such a furor about Justice Sotomayor's background and experience, about activist judges, and about this U.S. Supreme Court being above that. Why are we talking politics?
Yeah, so what's interesting is the data show that justices on the U.S. Supreme Court are not partisan. They are highly ideological, but they are not partisan. And those are two quite
different
concepts,
right? Tell us what the
difference is. So partisan is having, when you're partisan, you have an allegiance to one of the parties, right? So you are voting because you are a Republican or voting because you are a Democrat. And there's very little evidence that justices on the U.S. Supreme Court act in that way. They're not voting in cases because they are a Republican or a Democrat or were earlier in their lives, but they are ideological. We know that they vote conservatively and they vote liberally because they have political preferences, ideological preferences, legal preferences over how they would like to see the law and policy written in the United States, both federally and at the state level. So that comes back to the caller's question or the tweet, and that is, why are we talking about this in partisan terms? Because the initial fight is very partisan. That is, a president who has a party, in this case a Republican, is going to nominate someone whom he thinks will carry out the policies with which he agrees. And then that nominee is sent to the Senate. And again, there's going to be a partisan debate over this person. But underlying all of that is, how is this person going to act ideologically once he or she is put on the U.S. Supreme Court?
And by the way, David, we should note that justices often disappoint the presidents who thought they had their ideology right. Yes?
Sure, that's true. Some of that is a matter of doing your homework. Justice Souter is probably one of the most obvious examples of this, where when he was appointed, basically the job was delegated to John Sununu, who had been governor of New Hampshire and was chief of staff at the time. He said, oh, Souter, he's a good guy. And he turned out to be far more liberal, you know, than President Bush 41 ever thought. So I think it's the part of the partisanship is, where are the names coming from? So we know this list was developed by the Federalist Society, a very particular kind of conservative, a way far right kind of conservative. Other voices are not being heard. The president is not, say, consulting with moderate senators like a Murkowski or a Collins to come up with this list. They might like to have a role, but less so. So if you are picking people because of their partisanship and they're hoping that they are going to be reliably ideological, then it's only fair on the other side to examine that closely. If instead you're looking for people who are of broad competence, a Justice Stevens comes to mind. Yes, President Ford appointed him, and he turned out to be a moderate, but I don't think anybody looked into his personal views when he came onto the court.
Interesting conversation here with our guest, David Levine from UC Hastings in San Francisco College of Law. Tim Johnson with us from University of Minnesota, where he teaches law and political science. If you're just getting in on this, where we've been analyzing the role that Justice Kennedy played on the U.S. Supreme Court, some of the key decisions, what it will mean to remove his pivotal role, I guess, on the court and bring in a more conservative justice. And then we've been analyzing specific issues that may be affected by this. If you have a question about those specific issues, maybe some of these cases that are headed to the U.S. Supreme Court or that you're curious about, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Tim, you reminded me off air that Kennedy wrote the opinion for Bush v. Gore.
No, so he didn't write the opinion. He was involved in the opinion, right?
Okay.
So the court handed down a per curiam opinion, which what means by the court, but then he wrote one of the concurring opinions.
So tell me why. I'd forgotten all about that.
Right.
That was a big deal at the time.
Right. I mean, so
why does that stand out for you?
So the reason Bush v. Gore stands out for me in particular is that the five who ostensibly voted for that per curiam opinion were five of the biggest states' rights justices who have ever sat on the U.S. Supreme Court. So it was Rehnquist, O'Connor, Kennedy, Scalia, and Thomas, who are all very big adherents of states' rights. And that case in particular was, at its very core, while it did pick the president of the United States, it was a federalism case because the decision had been made by the Florida Supreme Court based on Florida state standards not to do or to do a recount.
Right.
And the court overturned that decision. And that flew in the face of what was a key part of Justice Kennedy's jurisprudence. We can talk about the others, but today we're talking about him.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of his jurisprudence was a very staunch believer in federalist principles. And so that ends up being a very key case because it went against his beliefs on federalism in order to elevate someone to the presidency of the United States.
By the way, what do you think the motivation was among those other justices to intervene the way they did, given their views?
Right. So I think that it probably was ideological in some sense. On the other hand, I think that once they got mired in the muck, and I think that all nine who were on the bench at the time believe they got mired in a muck that they really didn't want to be mired in. And I think that they were very willing to trade their beliefs on federalism for someone who they thought would be an ideological ally.
Hmm. Interesting. So, David, do the justices often only ever so reluctantly get into some of these difficult issues, as in getting mired in the muck? We really don't want to have to intervene here, but I guess we're going to have to. Is that how they feel sometimes?
Sometimes, absolutely. I mean, I think specifically, if we're talking about Bush versus Gore, going back to that, there was this ping pong going on between the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington. And at first, one of the earliest opinions the U.S. Supreme Court issued there was a very deferential opinion to the Florida Supreme Court. You know, essentially, we want you to take care of this, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And there was a turn by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think what happened is that at first there had been this compromise to say, let them go ahead. We'll give a little bit of guidance. Let Florida Supreme Court handle this. But then it looked so chaotic. And there was a point where it looked like the Florida Supreme Court was not giving sufficient deference to the guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court. And then I think the justices who, in some mix of the ideological and a desire to just step into what they thought was a messy situation, they jumped in at that point. The other thing I was going to say is tied to this about can you jump in or not is we haven't yet talked about the fact that one of the very important powers of the justices is they get to choose their docket. Lower court judges, by and large, can't choose their docket. U.S. Supreme Court, of course, chooses its docket by looking at cases that are presented for review, and at least four justices have to agree to hear something.
So sometimes there's opportunity there, but the justices just, and maybe there's a need there, but the justices decide that it's not time for the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in. Is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Exactly. The two that came up this year, for example, the Wisconsin redistricting case, of course, the Supreme Court ended up punting on that, sending it back down for further proceedings. But there was a North Carolina case, very similar issues on partisan gerrymandering, that was sitting waiting to be where the issue was, should it be heard or not?
Uh-huh.
Well, the Supreme Court decided not to hear that case. And in the masterpiece cake, the one about whether the baker could decide not to sell a cake to that gay couple, there was a very similar case sitting called Arlene Flowers. And again, the Supreme Court could have taken it up. Instead, they sent it back down to the courts in the state of Washington to reconsider it. So they pushed away cases that they might have heard.
Hmm. Call here from Liz in Wisconsin. Hey, Liz. Hi.
Hi. My question also relates to the abortion. If abortion is ruled
overturned Roe v. Wade.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What happens to many of the birth control devices, which many on the right consider abortifacients?
Yeah, this is actually something we'll talk about when we talk about abortion early next week. But Tim, what do you think are some of those? We've got pharmacists who are refusing now to prescribe Plan B or some of these devices.
Right. So those decisions will by and large be left up to state legislatures as to whether or not those devices or those particular medications could be sold or prescribed even within their own states. And so what'll happen is, and David alluded to this earlier, you're going to end up with a patchwork of states that might continue to allow abortion more generally, a progressive state like California, and other states that will say no abortion procedures and no abortifacients or other drugs or devices that can be sold in our state at all. And so you're going to have some very progressive states, some very conservative states, and then a lot of gray in the middle.
So interesting, given what just happened in Ireland and where this how this issue is, and gay marriage and what's happening in the rest of the world. Call here from Glenn in Superior, Wisconsin. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
What do you want to know?
Why can't we put this on the ballot and let the American people decide whether abortion should be legal or not?
Well, that's what individual state legislatures are supposed to represent. Do you want to say something on that, Tim?
Sure. So, I mean, very much so. Individual state legislatures can do this, make those decisions, or they could put it, states could put it on a ballot for referendum. But right now, because the U.S. Supreme Court says that nationally, this is a right that women possess to choose to have abortion on demand, it's not something that would generally need to be put up to a vote within a state. Now, what will happen is more conservative states that would like to inhibit or get rid of that particular right, they can indeed put it on the ballot up for referendum if they would like to. That can and does happen. And then, of course, many of those laws end up going through the federal court system because there are lawsuits that simply say, you've passed this law. It flies in the face of established precedent from 1973, and we're asking the courts to overturn those laws.
David, I'm curious, and I'm going to ask Tim about this too, whether in your years of practicing law and teaching law and watching the courts, how you see the moment that we're in with the U.S. Supreme Court. Put it in historical context for us.
Well, we're on the precipice of a big change. Every time there's a change of a justice, there, without a doubt, there's a change because the whole dynamic of the court will shift in different ways. But surely this is as momentous as, say, the shift from Chief Justice Warren, who brought us Brown versus Board of Education, to Chief Justice Berger. That kind of a shift. So yeah, I really think that we're looking at a big, big change of that sort. Sometimes justices slip in and there's not that much change. But this is one that, without a doubt, we're looking at the precipice of a lot of change.
David, so good to have you from California this morning. Thank you for the insight and the analysis.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Tim, how would you view this?
So I think that David's right. That's a great comparison. The other is the justice who Justice Kennedy replaced. When Justice Lewis Powell announced his retirement and President Reagan nominated Robert Bork, the left, beginning with Senator Ted Kennedy, went absolutely wild in fighting that particular nomination and were able to actually stop that nomination. And the reason they were so concerned was you had a right-leaning moderate, and the president wanted to put someone on who was so far to the right that would change the face of the court for 20, 30, 40 years. The exact same thing is happening now. The difference is, at the time, you had divided government. The Democrats controlled the Senate. The president was a Republican. And so the Democrats had something to fight with. Now, one party controls the White House and the Senate. And so this is going to be a much easier process, even though publicly I think there will seem to be a big fight. The process in the end is going to be pretty easy, and it will ultimately change the court as much or more than when Kennedy joined the bench in 1987.
Your point is well taken. When we're going to hear a lot of bluster and public show about opposing this, and I think that's all heartfelt on the part of Democrats, but you're saying look beneath that because there's really not much they can do, partly because of some of the rule changes that they wanted.
Exactly right. They made their bed in this case, and it's making it incredibly easy, or at least a lot more easy, for the president and Mitch McConnell to have this go pretty smoothly, despite, as you said, all the bluster everywhere else.
Really good question here from Jill in Stillwater. Jill, can you make it quick? I've got 2 minutes.
Yes. I'm just wondering why he has decided to retire now when we have such a super polarized nation.
Yeah, that's being asked in a lot of quarters.
That's a phenomenal question. It's a very personal decision. I would imagine, although none of us know for sure, that he's been thinking about this for 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Is that how it usually works?
Yeah, he's been thinking about it. He's 81 years old. I think that there is some idea that he might be infirm in some way, although nobody knows that for sure and nobody has talked about that. And it could be that he's just done. Absolutely right. Maybe he should be thinking about the future, if you will, but that's not how we make personal decisions, and the only person who decides is the individual at the time.
I mean, isn't it funny that this may be the only place in American society where we say, you're 81, why are you retiring now, right?
Absolutely right.
Because most people think 81, well, you head off and live your life.
That's right.
In retirement. Tim, really great to have you. Thanks so much for the insight and the analysis.
Pleasure to be here.
And I want to let you know that conversation that we're having about abortion is coming up at 9 o'clock on Tuesday. We're considering some of these individual state laws and what they mean for Roe. But now, given the discussion this morning, what happens overall to Roe v. Wade, 9 a.m. on Tuesday morning.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.